All right, tonight we're in Genesis 34. Last time we were together, we finished up with Esau and Genesis 33, and then dipped into Genesis 36 a little as well. So we'll pick up tonight in 34:1, and Lord willing, get through the entire chapter. So Genesis chapter 34, verse 1. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. And he was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this young girl for a wife." Now Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter, but his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob kept silent until they came in. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. Now the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage, and intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us, and take our daughters for yourselves. Thus you shall live with us, and the land shall be open before you. Live and trade in it, and acquire property in it." Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, "If I find favor in your sight, then I will give whatever you say to me. Ask me ever so much bridal payment and gift, and I will give according as you say to me. But give me the girl in marriage." But Jacob's sons answered Shechem and his father Hamor with deceit, and spoke to them because he had defiled Dinah their sister. And they said to them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we consent to you. If you will become like us, and that every male of you be circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and go." All right, so let's stop there for now. All right, so this is the beginning now of essentially the rest of the Old Testament, the tale of Jacob and his descendants. Now that Esau is out of the way, as it were, the rest of the book of Genesis will be about Jacob and his family. And then there will be a period of a few hundred years, and Exodus 1 will pick up then with the Israelites in slavery in Egypt. So this first tale, as it were, as we meet Jacob's sons, is not a good story, right? So in my Bible, at least the New American Standard Version, the title above the chapter is "The Treachery of Jacob's Sons," and actually that was the title of a sermon that Pastor Wayne preached. I believe it was in February of 2016, so about 18 months ago now. So it was a long time ago. So that sermon was very helpful, and so let's just go through here. So Dinah, the daughter of Leah, and we find out as Simeon and Levi's sister, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. So it looks as though Dinah is roaming a bit here. It is true, and Wayne mentions this in his sermon, that the commentators look upon this unfavorably with regard to Dinah. She's out roaming around. Literally, it says Dinah went out to see the daughters of the land, and so she's doing some intermingling here. And John Calvin, especially, if I remember going through the commentaries, notes that Dinah was probably out of her element and probably outside the will of God here, wandering around, perhaps seeing how the Canaanite women conducted business. None of that, of course, justifies what's about to happen to her. Nonetheless, there's a warning there. For roaming and for being curious. Verse 2, when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. Verse 3, and he was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. So there's no doubt here that this was a violation, a rape. As we see the instances of rape and sexual perversion in the Bible, this one is a little bit different. So there are other instances where a violation of this sort results in the man then subsequently rejecting the woman. And that's clearly not the case in this case, right? So just in terms of speculating a little bit about the relationship, it's clear that Shechem was fell head over heels, as it were, for Dinah. There was probably some amount of interaction between them, right? Obviously some resistance on Dinah's part, but then ultimately overtaken by Shechem. And just a terrible, terrible incident anytime this happens, and that's something we ought not to wish on anyone. But certainly the text is very clear at the end of verse 2. Shechem was overtaken with her, and he took her and lay with her by force. And he genuinely loved Dinah, it says in verse 3. This actually, literally, it says, and his soul clung to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. And so now he wants to marry Dinah after this occurs. Verse 4, so he speaks to his father Hamor, saying, get me this young girl for a wife. So obviously Hamor is a leading man, if not the leading man, of the city of Shechem. And his son here is the prince of the land, as it says in verse 2. And so this word gets back now, verse 5, to Jacob, Dinah's father. And it says specifically that he's alone, right? He's not with his sons here. And so it says he kept silent until his sons came in, specifically the sons Simeon and Levi. And the commentators are really divided. We don't have a lot of information as to what Jacob's silence means. Some would say that his silence was just sort of a result of his sadness, right? He didn't know what to say, in some sense. And so he just waits and seeks out two of his three eldest sons for counsel. Again, that would be Simeon and Levi. Some see here and read into this perhaps Jacob giving up some of his authority in his household, since Simeon and Levi later in the story certainly take front and center with regard to how this situation ought to be dealt with. So anyway, Jacob is silent for some time while his sons were with the livestock. And then Hamor, verse 6, the father of Shechem went out to Jacob to speak with him, right, to enter into negotiations with Jacob for the hand of his daughter Dinah, whom his son Shechem had raped but was in love with. So, verse 7, the sons of Jacob come in from the field. When they hear this, they were grieved and they were very angry. All right, so this is significant. They're very angry from the beginning. And it's probably here at the end of verse 7, a note from Moses, the author. They were very angry because Shechem had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. So we see here some foreshadowing of what will come later, most likely in the Pentateuch. So there's a couple of things that denote that. First of all, he uses the word Israel instead of Jacob. Now, it is true that we've already seen that Jacob is going to be renamed. But I think here this is an indicator of Moses' authorship. And as he recounts the historical narrative, he's providing some commentary there. And he's very clear about the fact that Shechem lying with Jacob's daughter is something that ought not to be done. And so there's probably multiple layers to this. The first layer, of course, being the rape, right? There are laws for such things in Israel as part of the Pentateuch. But also, there's probably some secondary understanding here about just the inner marriage itself that would also apply to the nation Israel, right? So this is not how marriage ought to happen. It ought not to be initiated by rape, again, although there are stipulations for that in the Mosaic Law, and Israelites, descendants of Jacob, ought not to intermarry with the Canaanites, right? So a couple of levels there as well. So the sons now, Simeon and Levi, have come in from the field. And so this sets the stage in verse 8. Hamor spoke with them. So now this would be at least Simeon and Levi, if not also including Jacob, saying, "The soul of my," and he's speaking primarily to Jacob here, we see in verse 8, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him," Shechem, "in marriage, and intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us, and take our daughters for yourselves. Thus you shall live with us, and the land shall be open before you. Live and trade in it, and acquire property in it." Right, and so this is basically the terms of agreement that are offered to Jacob. Now remember, Hamor is the Canaanite. He lives here. He's at least a leading man of the city, if not the leading man of the city. He is actually the one who's holding, as it were, most of the cards. Right, he's essentially bargaining with Jacob to basically make Jacob a part of the Canaanite population, even a city dweller related to Shechem. Right, Jacob here, actually though, because of Shechem's love for Dinah, is the one who's really holding the cards. Right, so there's this interesting deal going on. Right, so in terms of land and possessions and citizenship, Hamor owns the cards, but we see that Shechem is being overtaken with his infatuation of Jacob's daughter. Right, and we see later plenty of times in the Bible where men are overtaken with this infatuation of a woman, and it rarely ever leads to something good. And so this is where we're headed here. So that was verse 10. So Shechem, now the prince, Hamor's son, verse 11, also said to her father, Jacob, and to her brothers, Simeon and Levi, "If I find favor in your sight, then I will give whatever you say to me. Ask me ever so much bridal payment and gift, and I will give according as you say to me. But give me the girl in marriage." Okay? And so now, again, these Hivites, who are essentially holding the cards, right? They're the ones who own the land, they own the property, right? Jacob is this, he's not a Canaanite dweller, all right? They're basically giving up the whole thing here. "Ask me whatever you want, and I will give it to you." All right? This is going to turn out to be quite a rash vow. Right? Because Jacob's sons now will enter into the negotiations. So Jacob's negotiations disappear, and now Jacob's sons enter into the negotiations. Verse 13. "Jacob's son answered Shechem and his father Hamor with deceit and spoke to them because he had defiled Dinah, their sister." So remember, verse 7, they're grieved, they're very angry about the fact that their sister Dinah has been violated, and now they are the ones who realize they're holding the cards in the negotiations, and so they are going to do the negotiating, and they're going to do it clearly here with deceit. Verse 14, "And they said to them, 'We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we consent to you. If you will become like us, and that every male of you be circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you and become one people. All right? So, the sins now are multiplying, right? So we already have rape. We have a rash vow in the case of Shechem, right? We had Dinah, who was probably roaming past where she ought to have been. And now we have Jacob's sons, who are, I mean, the sins are going to come fast and furious now, right? And at the end of the day here, right, this beginning of sins for Simeon and Levi finds its root, sadly, in religion, right? In religion, right? And religion of the highest sort. We're talking about the Abrahamic covenant, right? How many hours did we spend around this table talking about the importance of the Abrahamic covenant, even to the gospel we proclaim of Christ crucified? And here we have Jacob's sons, right? Abraham's great-grandsons, who are now using the Abrahamic covenant of circumcision as a means of deceit, and ultimately, as we'll see later in the chapter, murder. Mass murder. Right? And so we have this religion of the highest sort that's used deceitfully for murderous gain. Okay? Simeon and Levi never had any intention of giving our daughters to the Hivites, nor of taking the Hivites as their wives. Okay? Although we find out later in the chapter, actually, they kill the men but bring the wives home with them, and so we don't necessarily know how that turns out completely. Okay? But at the end of the day, all of this, 14, 15, and 16, it's all a lie. Right? It's all for the purpose of deceit. The use of the Abrahamic covenant of circumcision, basically what they're going to do is they're going to cripple all of the men of Shechem, right, for murderous gain. So in verse 17, they basically say, take it or leave it, right? If you will not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and go. So this is it. This is our final offer. All right? Verse 18. Now their words seemed reasonable to Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. That verse blows me away every time that this this seemed reasonable to them. Okay? But here we go, verse 19. And the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. Now he was more respected than all the household of his father. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke to the men of their city, saying, these men are friendly with us. Therefore let them live in the land and trade in it, for behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters in marriage and give our daughters to them. Only on this condition will the men consent to us to live with us, to become one people, that every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock and their property and all their animals be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will live with us. And all who went out of the gate of his city listened to Hamor and to his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. Now it came about on the third day, when they were in pain, that two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the city unawares and killed every male. And they killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went forth. Jacob's sons came upon the slain and looted the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys and that which was in the city and that which was in the field, and they captured and looted all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives, even all that was in the houses. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And my men being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my household. But they said, should he treat our sister as a harlot? So, apparently Hamor and especially Shechem, right, and I can't get this sort of image of Gaston out of my mind, right? This sort of, like, he's a big guy, prince of the city. He's able to persuade all the men of the city, right, and that this is the right thing to do, right? And it's because, you know, he's in love with Dinah, right? It just blows my mind, but hey, you know. And the young man did not delay, right? Verse 19 doubles down, did not delay to do the thing. So it's actually, so he runs home. He's delighted with Jacob's daughter, and he's very much respected. And they spoke. They came to the gate of their city, right? This is where the business is done. We've discussed this before. This is where all the leading men of the city would meet. They spoke to the men of their city. And you can see here, there's actually a progression here. So look in verse 21, these men are friendly with us. Let's let them live in the land and trade in it. The land is big enough, right? Then you progress on to this intermarriage. Let their daughters, right? Let us take their daughters in marriage and give our daughters to them, right? Then there's the condition, which is circumcision of every male. And then in 23, right, it actually progresses now past that and turns into, will not their livestock and their property and all their animals be ours, right? And so now it has proceeded past the terms, and now there's this sort of selfish gain aspect of it as well. They see that Jacob is a very rich man. God had obviously, as we've seen in the past couple of studies, as he went out east, he God blessed him very much as he was working for his uncle Laban, and he comes back with all of these, all of this livestock. If you remember, right, he's coming in droves and droves, five different droves we saw, and so now the men of Shechem, specifically Hamor and his son Shechem, they're looking to see that they're looking for gain from Jacob, this wealthy man, and so they agree to give themselves over to circumcision, right? I mean, there wasn't even a thought. There's no question of what Jacob's God is even like. In fact, Wayne mentions in his sermon from February of 2016, God's actually not even in the chapter anywhere, right? God's not in the chapter anywhere. Certainly Jacob doesn't consult God for how to deal with this situation. Certainly Simeon and Levi and the other of Jacob's sons do not consult God. And then when the offer is made, the covenant of circumcision to be given to the men of Shechem don't even care about who this God is, right? They're Canaanites, they're pagans, they figure, right, this is religion for greedy gain. They don't really even care who the God of Jacob is here. And so, right, so we have this mere religion for greedy gain. I was thinking of Paul writing to Timothy, right, that there are so many who believe that godliness is a means to gain, right? And this is what we have here clearly in the case of Hamor and the Shechemites, okay? So anyway, they present the condition, verse 22, only on this condition will the men consent to us, to live with us, to become one people, that every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. Verse 24, and almost unbelievably, all who went out of the gate of his city listened to Hamor and to his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city, right? So we're talking about just mass persuasion of what we call biblical proportions here, right? This is you know, almost unbelievable. So anyway, they all agree to it. All the men of the city all agree to it. More godliness for greedy gain. And of course, this is the circumcision itself is an event, but the healing process is in fact a process, right? And it takes some time. And apparently, Jacob's sons were aware of the process, and so they find the high point of the pain and suffering, as it were, here, which apparently is the third day, verse 25, when the men of Shechem were in pain. Two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the city unawares and killed every male. Okay. clear violation of what we would call lex talionis, right? The law of retaliation, which comes later in the Pentateuch, right? So you can find it in multiple places in the writings of Moses, but specifically Exodus 21, for example, right? This eye for eye, tooth for tooth, right? And so, you know, we have to ask ourselves, just based on justice, whether or not this is the right response of Simeon and Levi, right? If nothing else, Shechem was the only person who was guilty here, right? You could perhaps, by implication, indict Hamor, all right? But certainly, to put all of the males of Shechem to death is clearly outside the bounds of justice. This is not how God would have us to deal with others in this situation. And again, as I mentioned, God is not even mentioned in the entirety of the chapter here. They killed every male. They killed Hamor, verse 26, and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword, and they took Dinah from Shechem's house and went forth. So they steal back, or take back, as it were, I guess, their sister Dinah, bring her back into Jacob's home. Jacob's sons, it is likely that this includes the rest of the sons who were old enough to do so at the time, following along. Certainly not involved in the killing. The text is clear on that. But most likely angry, most likely grieved about what happened as well, and certainly took advantage of the situation. They come upon the slain. They looted the city, verse 27, again, because they had defiled their sister. And, of course, we see in 28, 29, they loot the city of Shechem essentially completely, right? They clean it out. Took the wives and the little ones back with them. Verse 30, Jacob's response. Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And my men being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my household." And this is not a real great commentary on Jacob's response here. He moves immediately, at least as far as we can tell from the text, he moves immediately to self-concern, right? His own well-being. We see here no reprimand of Simeon and Levi and the other sons for having not executed justice in a rational way. But now he's concerned for his own welfare and the welfare of his household. You can see that very clearly there. And then he gets, and again, there's no invoking of God or any law of God that might have been revealed to him, the principles of God, and so then there's no conviction. Verse 31, they, the sons, said to Jacob, "Should he treat our sister as a harlot?" Right, so there's no conviction, no repentance, only self-justification for what they had done. Okay, so this is a terrible chapter. Frankly, it's a matter of grace. Again, frankly, that God continues to use Jacob and his family after such things. And this will not be the last we hear of the treachery of Jacob's sons. Right? We have the rest of Genesis to see how Reuben disqualifies himself as being the rightful heir of Jacob. And then, of course, there's the extended discussion in the last 10 chapters or so of Genesis about how the brothers treat Joseph, the dreamer. Wayne points this out in his sermon, and so I want to point it out here. If you fast forward a little bit to Genesis chapter 49, the end of the book of Genesis, Genesis 49, Jacob is getting ready to die, and he's pronouncing blessings and curses, frankly, over his sons. And in Genesis chapter 49, it says in verse 1, "Then Jacob summoned his sons and said, 'Assemble yourselves that I may tell you what shall befall you in the days to come.'" And I'll skip over 2, 3, and 4, because those have to do with Reuben, the firstborn, which we will get to in a bit here in our study. But let's pick up in verse 5. So this is Jacob speaking over Simeon and Levi, and actually Wayne points out in his message that very often in the Jewish Midrash, Simeon and Levi are together. It seems like, you know, they were very close, had Leah as their mother, and so hanging out together and obviously committing sins together here, as we saw in Genesis chapter 34. So in the pronouncement over his second and third born sons, Jacob joins them together as well. And he says, beginning in verse 5, "Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly, because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." And then he moves on to the fourthborn Judah in verse 8. Right? So these are significant curses. It turns out that neither one, again by God's grace, neither one of the brothers, Simeon and Levi, are excommunicated, as it were. They both did get inheritances in the promised land. So Simeon, he was always among the weakest of the tribes in terms of number. He also, if you go to a good study Bible and it has a drawing of how the land was apportioned out in the latter half of the book of Joshua, you will find that the land of Simeon is actually completely encapsulated within the land that was allotted to Judah. So Simeon is given a very, very small piece, and arguably not even an independent piece of the promised land. And over time, the land of Simeon was basically swallowed up by the southern kingdom. All right, and so Simeon actually, in some sense, never gets redeemed. He never gets redeemed. Right? None of his descendants make up for what Simeon did here in Genesis chapter 34. Now, that's different from Levi. So Levi is very interesting, right? So as we know our Old Testament history, the Levites were the ministers in the tabernacle, right? Moses himself is a Levite, Moses and Aaron. When they go into the promised land in the time of Joshua, they also do not have a portion of the promised land, except for they were given cities in all of the other pieces of land that were allotted to the tribes, right? So the Levites get cities and the land surrounding the cities, but have no land-based inheritance in the promised land because God is their inheritance. And the reason why the Levites get such a high standing, right, is because they were, in a sense, redeemed later on in the Exodus account. Right, so in the Exodus account, Moses goes up to the top of the mountain while the Israelites are down and they're carousing and they're playing and they're building false gods and this sort of thing. And when Moses comes down, Moses is obviously very angry, and he says, "Who's on the side of God? Right? Who's going to basically take care of all this carousing, this pagan idolatry? Who's going to eradicate this from the nation Israel?" And who are the people who gather to Moses' side? It's the Levites. Right? So later on, hundreds of years later, members of the tribe of Levi actually get a zeal for God. They side with Moses. They side with the Lord. They're instrumental in cleansing the Israelites of their pagan idolatry. And so they are granted a place, a respectable place in the inheritance of God. Again, not from a land-based perspective, but certainly as serving in the tabernacle, which was a very high and exalted place.
You can read about that in Joshua 21, 1 through 42, by the way.
Okay.
It's very specific.
Okay, Joshua 21. All right, so we have Simeon and Levi, brothers, joined at the hip, both guilty in Genesis 34, but Simeon not redeemed, right, and eventually swallowed up. Levi redeemed because of the zeal of the Lord, of the ancestors of Levi. Okay? But we will see when we get to Genesis 49 and we see in more depth the blessings and the curses, we will see that, again, Reuben forfeits his blessing for his actions, which we will see soon. And then Simeon and Levi also forfeit their blessings as well. And so we'll see those blessings passing on to Judah, which obviously has significant ramifications for us in our understanding of the gospel. Any other comments, Mike?
No.